Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
Got tears in my eyes before I even got up here. I'm grateful to be here also. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And I don't know what I'm going to say. I don't know what's going to come out of it. I've got 20 minutes to do it, and so we'll do it together. I like to pray to God before I say anything because my ego will get in the way if I don't. And there's a lot of people out here, and so God's in charge, so we'll see what's going to happen. Coming up here and seeing Robin brought back a lot of memories. And I mentioned to her that my memory's not that great. And sometimes situations like this will bring back stuff, which is good. And I was able to talk to Robin about things that I wasn't able to talk to other people about because they weren't there and things like that. I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to do a drug-a-log or a drunk-a-log. We don't have time for that, and we've all used, we all know what that was like. Some people's stories and where they went, is crazier than where I went, and mine's sometimes where I went was crazier than where you went. The thing for me was I used drugs and alcohol to hide the way I was feeling. I was scared to feel whatever it was. I didn't know how to. Growing up in my family was, the more I think about it, was my parents weren't really there. My mother worked at night, and my father came home from work and started drinking until he passed out. So it was like there was nobody there. And so we were never taught how to communicate other than with, the way they did with anger, my mother especially. And that didn't allow me to understand a lot of things about growing up. I didn't have anybody to share anything with. And I know that's, a lot of things that I'll say will just be for me. And I just needed to say that because I'm not trying to impress anybody. I just am here to share with you what has, what went on with me. And so growing up, it got to be, growing up as a kid is scary anyways, and then not being able to share any of those things with anybody made it even worse. So I grew up with a lot of fear. And I found that, first of all, drinking at least covered up that fear for a while. And that was great, and that worked for a long time. And drugs did the same thing for me. And that's why I used both of them to the extent that I did, because they worked at first. They worked for a while. And it changed me into a different person. I wasn't the scared, shy, skinny, and whatever else I thought I was at that time. It was all very negative. I didn't have a good feeling about myself. My mother always told me, well, you got to learn how to like yourself. Well, I didn't know how to do that. I didn't have any experience at that. So using drugs and alcohol helped me a lot. through high school, you know, when drugs and alcohol were still working, I had a lot of fun. And, you know, I worked with some kids at a hospital by where I live, and they're 15, 16 years old, and they're in a recovery unit, and I don't understand that at all. Because at that age, there's nobody who could have told me that I had a problem with either drugs or alcohol. I was still having a lot of fun with them at that time. And these kids are in there, you know, trying to recover at that age. And I think it's great, but I think it's scary also because they've got to go back out to high school and whatever else and try and stay clean. I think it's going to be difficult for them. But it's been one of the greatest gifts I've been given out of the many, many, many gifts I've been given in the program was to work with those kids or just to be a part of it anyways. Because that time in my life, I needed something to get through. There's no way I could have done it without drugs or alcohol. My parents weren't able to, you know, give me the help that I needed. And I always thought that maybe it was because of their age. They were older than most of my friends' parents. And I thought, well, they didn't get involved with my life because of their age. But it wasn't it. It was because of their addiction and alcoholism. And, you know, it just was tough. It was tough. You know, and even when it was fun, it was tough. I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling. And I didn't know what to do about it. And that's the biggest, you know, I felt uncomfortable for a lot of years of my life. And today, the thing that's different is I'm learning how to deal with that with the tools of the programs. I guess when I met Robin was with a trunk full of beer, and my best friend was Robin's husband. Not at that time, but when we met, I brought a couple of cases of beer over, and we got drunk. Coming up here and seeing Robin now brings back some memories of her. And I don't want to embarrass her, but she was an ornery drunk. And I remember one time we were at the school and she was, I know, I just got to do this one, little one. And she was real drunk, and we were trying to help her walk, and she got pissed off. She didn't want any help. She was real stubborn. I don't know if she's like that anymore. But we, you know, the group of people we hung around with partied a lot, and to this day, I couldn't talk to them the way I've talked with a person here tonight, as open as I did with this person tonight. I couldn't tell them how I feel inside. I couldn't tell them that I get scared still. I couldn't tell them that I wanted my life to be different. I couldn't tell them anything. I had to act a certain way to protect myself around all those friends. And it wasn't very much fun. I kept putting myself through that for a long time. Because I didn't know anything else. They were the only friends I had at the time. And that was the way it was with everything. I had to do this, live this life a certain way because I didn't know how else to do it. And I didn't like the way it was going. And it kept getting worse and worse and worse. And the feelings didn't go away. They got worse. You know, and I kept stuffing and stuffing and stuffing and stuffing. And to this day, I go to therapy with an ACA counselor, and we're talking about something about my father, and she says, "You're angry about that," and I said, "No, I'm not," and I didn't feel it, but there was anger there that, you know, I couldn't even really feel, but was there, that I'd stuffed so long ago that I didn't even recognize that what was going on. So what's happening now, the process of recovery, things start coming up when I can handle them and learn how to do it, you know, one day at a time. You know, I'm jumping around, and that's okay. That's just kind of what's going on with me. Martin made me real nervous on the way over here. He's telling me that there's going to be 400 people here and that they were going to tape it, and I couldn't believe that at all. And then they're taping it. So, I worked in restaurants for a while, and that was a real party situation. Working in restaurants is everybody parties, and you use drugs to get through the day because you have to work so fast and so hard that we started. I started using speed, and that was a favorite of mine for a long time. And that allowed me to drink a lot more, and I'd still black out, but I'd stay up longer and I'd drink more. Yeah. So I know you can relate to that. Okay, I'm feeling something inside. I'm real nervous, and I just I don't know where I'm going with this, but I know it's just 20 minutes, and I can't tell you in 20 minutes what my life is like today. It's completely different, and even it's different from a year ago when I was in the program a year ago, the way I felt then. It's completely better than then. The way I feel about myself and where I'm going. A year ago at this time, I was obsessed with this girl, and it was painful, and you know, the holidays were coming up, and that was a difficult time for me. And I think even at this time a year ago, I was going to a couple meetings with Robin's ex-husband, who's my best friend and who I haven't seen since that time. And now a year later, I'm feeling some serenity and peace in my life, and I've experienced freedom in my life at different times, and that is one of the greatest feelings I've ever felt. It's not, you know, it's not like a rush from drugs or anything like that, because the real stuff still goes on. You know, all the things I used and drank over still go on in my life. You know, the things that happen in life still happen, but I don't use and drink over them anymore. I talk to people about it, and I write about it, and you know, I pray to God about it. You know, I hope that if I talk to you about God, it won't offend you or anything like that. But God has freed me of my addiction and the obsession for drugs and alcohol, and God has given me a love that I've never experienced in my life before. More, you know, not that the love that no human being could has given me, you know, or could, because I always depended on people to give me what I needed, and they couldn't do it. Now I learned through the books and the writings and the program that I need to depend on God today for what I need. And when I do that, I'm okay. You know, when I start depending on other people and expectations of other people are too high, I get hurt and I get let down, and it's not fair to those people. When I depend on God and I go to God for what I need, I get what I need. And I'll tell you, I don't do that perfectly. I don't do anything perfectly. I still try to control everything at different times, and I still want to do it myself. And sometimes I think I'm doing pretty good, and then it falls apart, and I have to go back to God, and that's when I get the help that I need. And it's happened to me recently with a job, and I've been, I mean, just totally amazed of the results. And it's because I had some time off. I quit a job, and I decided to take some time off, and then it became about, the time became 2 months, and I was running out of money, and I didn't have a job. and I was waiting for God to give me the perfect job, and it wasn't happening. And I went to a meeting and cried and asked for help, and ever since, and things have changed. I got a job making $6 an hour. And I say that because my ego and pride embarrassed me. I felt embarrassed about that for a little while. And what started to happen was I started having fun with the people I was working with, and I started enjoying what I was doing. And it didn't matter, you know. Once once I get the ego out of the way, I realize that there's more, you know, there's really much more involved in the situation than I could see otherwise. And I've met some people that are just, you know, just really super nice people. And because I just got myself out of the way, I realized that, you know, what was going on, and am able to enjoy it. But it just goes to show me that I don't know what I'm doing without help. You know, and I don't just get help from God. I get help from my friends. I get help from going to meetings. I get help from trying to serve God to the best of my ability. And, you know, it's not just one of those things. It's all been put together. And, you know, the message that I keep hearing other people share, and it keeps coming up almost every day that I go to a meeting, I keep hearing it, is just don't use and just don't drink, and everything will work out. And it seems to me like, you know, after a certain amount of time, you just know that, but I forget that, and I need to keep hearing that, because if I don't use anything, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to get through it no matter what. I'm getting through this, you know, and I'm not going to get voted over it. I wanted to thank a few of Robin's friends for making me feel welcome here. Appreciate it. I'm one of you. I'm equal with all of you. And that was a good lesson for me, because I was either better than people or less than people, and usually less. And that created a lot of fear for me. And I need to tell myself that I'm equal with all people, and that in these rooms we have something in common. And I'm grateful for that, because this is where I have to be to live my life the way I live it today. And I don't want to have that fear that I had, and I don't want to be lonely anymore. And when I believe that I'm equal with all people, that I'm not lonely, and I don't have that fear, and I want to cry, and it's just wonderful, and we're worthy of God's love, and it's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. Thank you very much.
My throat's all dry. I don't think I'll be able to talk now. I'm Scott, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Scott.
It's good to be here. It's always good to be here. The years I've been around, it's just good to be able to keep coming back. It's just good to have some place to show up to. There's a guy that talks about his definition of a spiritual person as someone that's wanted and needed and loved on this earth. You know, and I've learned that I'm a spiritual person, you know, and I want to share that with you, you know. And I hope by the end of this talk, you guys will be convinced. My gum falls apart in my mouth. It's like, if I go to take it out after it's too late, it does like spider webs on me. And it it still happens. I get all pumped up, and it's like all pumped up with no place to go, you know? I don't worry about seizures anymore because I haven't ever had a seizure up here. But I remember the first time I talked was at a young people's down in Sacramento, and I remember I kept thinking, oh God, what if you have a seizure in front of all those people? You know? And then the thought came right behind it, another thought came right behind it, says, that's okay, if you have a seizure, they'll get the message. You know, they'll still get the message, you know, because me just showing up is a message in itself, you know, because it's, if I was still using and drinking, you know, I wouldn't be showing up, you know. I wouldn't be having seizures anymore. I was on, you know, you've about had your last seizure, Scott, you know, the next one's going to be serious, that kind of stuff, you know. I haven't had a seizure in almost 10 years, you know, so I don't worry about them a lot anymore. Every once in a while I still think about it a little bit, you know. This would be a good night to have a seizure, you know. Boy, they'd really be entertained then, you know. There's an old guy down in Roseville who used to call me the entertainer. And as soon as I found out he called me that, I stopped entertaining him. You know, I got serious about everything. And I don't know. Usually I either talk a lot about what it was like, or I talk a lot about what it's like now. You know, but it's not very often I get to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Because, you know, I'm still, all the results aren't in yet, you know. I'm still tabulated, you know. But I find that it's necessary, it's vital that I tell you what it was like for me, you know. Because if I tell you what it's like now for me and you don't know what it was like, it doesn't mean much. It's kind of like, aside from the fact that I practice the principles of a program that's spiritual in nature on a daily basis and do my very best to stay clean and sober, and every day is a miracle. Outside of that, I live a pretty normal lifestyle, you know. So if I tell you what my life is like tonight, you know, and you don't know what it was like, what it used to be like, I'm an addict, alcoholic of the hopeless variety. You know, all my life I've been a hope to die dope fiend. You know. I guess that's the way I wanted it, you know. Well, that's the way it had to be. I don't think I ever wanted it like that. I didn't say, oh, good, if you're going to be a dope fiend, be the very best money can buy, you know. Maybe if you're real good at it, they'll let you be a convict, you know. I want to be an ideal inmate when I grow up. It's the way things turned out, you know. But I lived for drugs and I used drugs to live. And there was some controversy when I came into recovery about where I should do my time in recovery. When I got here, there's a guy, CW, running around these hills. He knows what it was like, you know. He had to inform me that I, no longer had an anchor on my ass, you know, and that if I wanted to drink or use, that was okay with him, you know, that was my choice. But if I did that, keep going, you know, just keep on going. But when I came in, it's like they said, well, did you substitute drugs for alcohol? I said, no. And they said, well, you say you drank like, you know, I tried to put away a quart a day. You know, what I buy is a half gallon. I buy a half gallon of vodka a day. You know, I didn't always drink it all, but I always drank as much of it as I could. You know? And, you know, and I tried to get over to my brother's as often as I could because he was like my connection, and he'd get the class A's, you know. He's been a methadone addict forever, you know. About 15 years off and on, mostly on, you know. And I'd go over and we'd do other drugs together. And it's like a... They said, yeah, well, you talk about doing as much of a quart as you possibly could a day, and you talk about doing these other things like Percodan and stuff like that. Were you substituting it? No. I said, well, how do you explain that? I said, well, you don't understand. I supplemented alcohol with other drugs. And I supplemented other drugs with alcohol, you know, because sometimes that shot of gum opium, you know, wasn't quite enough and you needed a couple of what they call hookers. You needed a couple of hookers to ease the pins and needles, you know. So, you know, so I supplemented. So there was some controversy about where they were going to stick me. You know, and I ended up in Morris's good graces back there. You know, they tricked me all the way up the mountain. You know, they tricked me all the way to here. You know, I guess it's most important that I'm here. You know, I first smoked pot when I was 13, and it was a spiritual experience for me. I felt music for the first time. And I liked it. I liked that. And I remember the first time I did amphetamine and I went to school. I was a freshman in high school. I did amphetamines and I went to school and I felt compassion for the first time. You know? I was running up and down the hallways crying, you know? Crying. And people would say, what are you crying for? I said, I'm not crying because I'm sad. I'm crying because I love you all so much. You know? And it's kind of like that was a turning point for me, you know? Up until then, my mom had always said, you know, you're lazy. You're lazy. You're unmotivated. And sometimes, you know, sometimes you're so lazy I can't stand to be around you. And I fixed that. You know, I found... She had 500 Dexamil in her jewelry box. And it's what I call motivational therapy. You know? I got motivated. You know, she'd wake up at 6 in the morning and I'd say, hi, Mom, coffee's on the stove. Made you an egg sandwich. And I cleaned all the cracks in the tile while you were sleeping. You know? How's that for motivation, Ma? She never trusted it, though. You know, always waiting for the other shoe to fall, you know? But, you know, speed set me free. Amphetamines, I like amphetamines. And yeah, I hadn't been doing them too long. And some guy showed me how to inject them. And I was one of those cats that said, I would never, 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 never stick a needle in my arm, you know? Until, you know, he says, wait a minute, you're never going to believe the way this feels. You know? I said, well, okay. You know, I'll let you try to convince me one time. It's the reason I talk about drugs, I don't try to glorify drugs. I tell you what it's like, and I try to hook it up to what it's like in sobriety. Because, you know, I've had connections in sobriety. Sobriety didn't just happen instantaneously. Recovery, my clean time, it didn't start saying, you know, bless you, go forth and sin no more. It's like a bunch of people, you know, turn me on. You know? And I said, God, I don't believe this sobriety. I don't believe this, you know. This is a new world, man. And someone like Morris would say, whoa, wait till you do the fourth step. And I say the profound stuff like, oh, I'll never settle for a third step only again, you know? That's the way, you know, that's the way I've done in sobriety. I came in here, I got hungry. I got hungry because it worked, and it's, you know, when you come to, when you realize that you're a hopeless, quote, hopeless bastard, you know, and you find some ray of hope, you know, it just kind of all breaks loose. And if you're not gathering hope on a constant, consistent, daily basis, it becomes painful real quick, you know, because it's like, I don't know if you can understand it, but it's like that darkness is ever looming. You know, that darkness of the same old crap. You know, I'd experienced the same old crap so long. I got here, they said, don't you want peace and harmony in your life? What a wonderful way to live. I said, no, I don't care about that crap. I made it 29 years without it. What do I want with it now, you know? I said, I just want something different. I need it to be different. I just want some semblance of chaos in my life. I just want to know when the next plaque's coming so I can duck. You know, that's all I was looking for, and I got a lot more. You know, I got a lot more. I got motivated when I was in high school. I set records when I was in high school. I didn't use drugs because I was stupid. You know, I was a straight-A student, class president, most popular kid in school when I was in sixth grade. And that meant something to me. You know, little old ladies would say, you must be very proud of your son. You know, and they'd pat me on the head. And I would beam, you know, and I liked it. And then I'd go rob the paper stands. I didn't use drugs because I was stupid. I didn't use drugs because I was ugly. I didn't use drugs because I was, you know. I used drugs primarily because they were there. And like Brian said, because they worked. You know, because they set me free. You know. One of the records I set at Novato High School down in Marin County, which isn't too far from San Mateo. I remember, I'm not real familiar with San Mateo County. You know, we used to consider San Mateo County line that invisible, that thin invisible line that once you cross over, you may never come back, you know. I used to go to San Bruno a lot. You know, when I came back from Missouri, my brother lived in San Bruno, and it was right off the freeway, and I go to San Bruno, and I might not come out for several days, you know, because usually he had drugs and stuff there. You know, of course, that's why I went there. But you'd have to know my brother. It's kind of like one night he cooked dinner for me for about 18 hours. And I had to leave before it was finished, you know. I love my brother a lot. He's been through a lot. I think he's almost here. He's almost here. You know, I tell you the truth, were it not for my brother, I wouldn't be here. My brother is one of the people that helped me get here. You know, but, I used drugs in Marin County. I cut school in Marin County because we live kind of close to the beach and everybody knows God lives at the beach, especially when you're 16 and you're doing amphetamines and grass. In Seagram 7, you know, we substituted those things for each other all the way to the beach and back, you know. I remember one day I got busted for this record I had established. It was for cutting one class. I cut one class 135 days. It was kind of a trip because when I got busted, you know, I know how it was for you. I'll keep saying I don't know how it was. I know how it was for you because you're sitting here. You know, if it was basically like it was for me. You know, I know if you guys weren't hopeless also. You don't come here on a winning streak. You've heard that 1,000 times, right? I know. I was tricked here. I didn't want. I wanted. I was more willing to go to prison than to come to here. You know, take me to prison. At least I'll survive there. I know I can survive there. You know, ain't no telling what those suckers be doing in NA meetings. You know. Burning incense and stuff, you know? But, I was hoping that I'd get caught. I was tired of running, you know, because I wasn't going to the beach anymore. I just couldn't go to class, and I didn't have any other place to go, so I just hide seventh period every day. You know, and I was praying they'd catch me so it'd be over with, you know. Finally, on the 135th day, they busted me, and the teacher says, how did you do this? How did 135 days, Scotty? I said, well, I cut the first day to go to the beach. The second day, I didn't have a note for the first day. So I cut again. And this is not all day. This is just one period. This is just seventh period every day. I was at school every day. I just cut last period. I said, so the second day I cut again. And then the third day, I couldn't come up with a valid excuse for missing one period 2 days in a row. So I cut the third day to give me some time to think. You know? And next thing I know, it's 135. And that's the way I use drugs, you know. It's like I didn't need a reason to use the first time. I didn't need a reason. It's just, you know, you just do it. And the second one is because you'd already done the first one. It's kind of like a commitment, you know. Then you do the third one. Next thing you know, it's 135, you know. And you're coming to in a hospital, you know. I don't know how many of you have done it, but you come to on a gurney in a hospital. You know, and their lights are different, you know, typical, you know. You open your eyes, you know where you are. You know, and then the nurse asks you the stupid question, you know. Do you know where you are? You know, and you say, yeah, I might be a dope fiend, but I ain't stupid, you know. Of course I know where I am, I just don't know how I got here. You know. You come to and you know you're in a jail cell. You know? Yeah, I know where I am, but could you tell me what county it is? You know? And that kind of stuff, you know? But, you know, that 135 stuff, that's the way I did, you know? It's, when I turned 16, it was the peace and love movement, and I guess I was shooting for peace and love, you know, or anything that even vaguely resembled it. I come from an alcoholic home, like Brian was talking about, and the anger is there, and it ain't so bad until you find out that not everybody lives like that, you know? And you come home and you try to share with your family. Oh, I was at some people's house. They had a weird family. You know? Mom tucks the kids in at night. You know? And the kids, the 10 and 11-year-old kids, don't cook dinner for the whole family and stuff like, you know, it's weird. You know? And it was like kind of like going to Oz for a night. You know, hey, next time I spend the night over here, can I bring my little sister? You know, she loved this, you know. She's never seen nothing like this, you know. But it's, you know, you don't talk, you don't trust, you don't feel, you know, it's just, anything's legal. You know, living in a dope fiend family isn't really too bad because anything's legal as long as you meet the two primary requirements. You know, as long as you don't get caught or you don't have too much fun. Those are two cardinal rules. You know, and even if you get caught, you can get over if you look remorseful enough. You know? Or even if you have too much fun, you know, you can get over as long as you don't get caught. But, you know, it's like if you get caught, if you get caught for having too much fun, you're in trouble. You know? You're no longer part of the family, you know? But it's like, that's where I grew up, and my stepdad, I had several stepdads, all of them alcoholic. And they considered that I was developing criminal attitudes and criminal skills, you know, and I was destined to lead a life of crime. And when I think about it, you know, they were at least uncanny skills. It's like I had the ability to be able to tell 59 Ford station wagon headlights from 150 yards away, because that's the kind of car the old man drove. I'd be out on the street, you know, don't you go out in the street. You might as well, you know, please go out in the street as soon as I leave, you know. Because that's what had happened. You know, I'm the kind of person, you tell me don't, I got to, you know, what am I missing, you know. But I'd be able to tell the headlights when they were coming around the corner, you know, and I pretended like I slept a lot, and I did some mean things to my stepdad. Of course, at the time, I thought he deserved every rank thing I ever did. I'm a stepdad now. I got a 15-year-old kid that does things to me, you know? And I go to this counselor, and I say, hey, he's doing it to me again. And she says, Scott, he's only 14 years old. He's not quite 15 years old. I said, you better tell him that. You know? He's doing stuff I was doing when I was 28, you know? But, you know, I had those abilities. We used to make raids on the Donut Man. You know, in Novato, when it was still a small town, at 4 a.m, the Donut Man used to come up to the Purity store in our neighborhood and just wheel a big rack of pastries up against the front of the store. And then he'd get in his truck and he'd drive away. And we'd come out of the bushes and we'd just take all these donuts and feed all the kids on the street. You know, it was like the donut connection. You know, I never got busted for that. I never, you know, you can go to prison for doing stuff like that. Dealing donuts to minors. You know, I never thought about it. And when I got into drugs, that's the way it was. You know, I never thought about dealing drugs to minors. You know, to this day, if people say, did you deal drugs? Were you a dealer? No. You know? But it's like, a lot of drugs flowed through my hands and a lot of money flowed through my hands, but it was like, it was on a communal basis, you know? And it was out of love and compassion for my fellow man, you know? My mom had a jewelry box with 500 Dexamil in it that my aunt gave to her because she had problem losing weight. And my aunt just dumped these 500 Dexamil on my mom, and no one ever came and took my mom away, and no one ever came and took my aunt away, and no one said nothing about it. You know? So, you know, and I was a minor. You know? So, that's just part of the deal, I guess. I guess that's part of the deal, but one of my values when I was 20 years old was you don't ever, ever, ever sell controlled substances to a unmarked narcotics agent. You know? And I stuck by it. You know? I mean, sure, I stuck needles in my arm, but I wasn't untrustworthy or anything. You know, I still had these values. You know? And when I was 18, my dad had just passed away from cirrhosis of the liver, alcoholism. And it was nasty. You know, it was nasty. I know a lot of people had everybody worried about hepatitis. You know? Everybody worried about hepatitis and, you know, this guy's shitting white. He's been shitting white for a month, you know, and he pees like root beer and it's grotesque and he can't get off the bed and he's swollen. My dad was like that for about 3 years. It was like every junkie, every speed freak I'd ever run with all rolled up in one, you know, and it was painful, you know, and it's kind of like my dad. When I looked in his eyes, I knew he was dying and there wasn't anything I can do about it. You know, the difference between then and now is I see people on a regular basis come in to the fellowship, and I see that they're dying. But I know that there's something can be done about it. I know just the fact that they're coming in here, there's hope. They got a chance of getting better. You know, I never got to see my dad do that. And you know, what you got to understand about my dad is he's the most important person in my life. I loved him. You know, he represented everything that was good about humanity to me. You know, he was strong, spiritual, and wise, you know. And I watched him die, you know. And I got loaded with him a couple times. I used to say, hey, Dad, why don't you smoke reefer with me? It's better than that red port. Damn. You know. I mean, I drank red port when I was 5 years old, and it left a mark on me. It kind of scarred me, you know. Of course, I drank it out of a teapot. I don't know how, you know. But I thought, you know, how do you hold out 47 years drinking that crap, Dad, you know. But he passed away, you know, and I guess that's when my feelings started kicking in. I'd always had some feelings, you know, but I kind of got used to them happening when I used amphetamines or happening when I smoked grass or happening when I drank too much vodka or whatever, you know. But it's kind of like now feelings were happening and it didn't matter what kind of drugs I used, the feelings happened anyway, you know. And what happened for me is like this big hole developed. It felt like a hole, you know? And I don't know, it's kind of like when you talk to someone and you say, look at that movement over there. And they say, well, can you see it? And I say, no, I can't see it, but I feel it. You know, I feel it. There's something happening over there. Check it out. You know, that's the way this hole was, you know, and it hurt and it was raw and it stunk. You know, it stunk, and sometimes the stench got real. As, speed freak, sometimes if you've been on a run for several weeks, you know, and, you know, maybe you're not eating real nutritious foods. You know, yeah, cereal, you know, you come to, yeah, but it's kind of like you've been on this run, right, and your body starts rotting inside. And this is a phenomenon that happens with drug users and people that are dying from terminal diseases, you know, and it's like I accidentally belch at a social gathering and smell like sulfur or rotten eggs, you know, and everybody look at you and say, what's that smell? And you look around and say, yeah, what is that smell, you know? And it's kind of like it was a tangible thing that, yeah, it ain't gonna last much longer. You know, I remember doing Why Am I? I don't know how many people ever did Why Am I? But, God, it still hurts. Ah! But, I used to do Why Am I? You know, and I'd walk into a room and it's like, Airwick is here. You know? What is that smell? You know? You go to take a bath and there's a yellow film floating on the water and you think, yeah, who's been tampering with the tub, you know? But I never thought that, you know, I was damaging myself. You know, I thought it was this whole, I thought it was what my growing up in that family did to me, what going to juvenile hall when I was 16, you know? Did 30 days in juvenile hall. I did good time. You know, I remember one night I had big fun when I did time. I don't know about anybody else, but I had big fun. You know, I was never happy. I was never happy, but I always did my best to have big fun. I remember in Marin County Juvenile Hall, I helped four guys escape out a window. And the last guy was going out and I was shoving on him. And he wouldn't go, and I was getting mad. You know? And I came to find out that there was a counselor on the other side of the window pushing them back in. And, you know, I'm trying to shove them out. And they came around and they busted us, you know? And they busted these other four guys, and they said, and you were trying to get away too, weren't you, Lemon? I said, no, I was barefoot. You know, and I still had your orange sweater on. If I was going to get away, surely I'd be smarter than that. I said, it ain't so bad here. You know, those other guys needed to leave. You know, their time was up. You know, so I did stuff like that. And you know, when I was 18, I got married to fill this hole up, you know, and I had a child to fill this hole up, and it still stunk, you know, and it still hurt. And my baby boy, he's got the blackest eyes. He's got those kind of eyes that look purple when you look into them, and it's like there's no bottom to them. You know, you look into his eyes, and it's like looking down a well, and you could see right to the pit of my existence, and it scared me, and I'd have to turn my head the right way, you know. And I loved him so much, but I couldn't be close to him, you know. Because I hadn't realized my potential as a human being. So I got a divorce, and I left the boy, and I moved up to Clay County where I didn't have to be arrested anymore, you know. I lived in Kansas City at the time, and we ripped and ran, and I know back streets. I don't know main streets. People used to ask me for directions, and I'd tell them how to go, and they'd come back 3 weeks later and say, God, it took me 6 hours to make a 15-minute drive, you know? I said, well, that's the way they showed me. You know, of course, we did it all with mirrors. You know, But I got arrested like 11 times in an 18-month period of time, right after I turned 18. A week after my 18th birthday, I got arrested. I spent 3 days in the city jail. They let me out. What was the next special occasion after my birthday? Probably my son's birth. My son was born in July. I went to jail for 3 days. And people say, oh, it's President Washington's. It's Washington's birthday. And I say, oh, God, don't say that. It means I've got to go to jail again. You know? Every special occasion, I'd end up in jail. And I got afraid that they were going to keep me there. You know? And they'd let me out of jail after 3 days, and I'd be running. I'd say, I'd never do that again. And I got divorced, and I moved up north of the river in Clay County, where Jesse James used to live. Jesse James and Scott F. Lemon. You know? And I got arrested up there. They were pretty good about it. They only arrested me once. You know? And what they arrested me for is... for selling to an unmarked narcotics agent. Which I would never do. They indicted me. I was indicted by the grand jury and arrested with 13 other guys. And we were the most organized drug ring ever apprehended in Clay County, Missouri. And we were so organized, none of us knew any of the other guys. But we got to know each other. You know? And at that time, sales of methamphetamine hydrochloride carried from 1 day in the county jail to 10 years in the state penitentiary. And I had 7 months worth of minimum sentence. And when I was in sixth grade, I was a straight-A student, most popular kid in the school, and class president. So even if they found me guilty, I knew they'd let me out after 7 months. And they didn't, you know, because I forgot about President Nixon in Washington doing all that stuff about, you know, these drug dope fiends, these hope die dope fiends, you know. So I was the only one that didn't cop a plea. I was the only one that went to a jury trial out of the 14 guys that got arrested. And they gave me maximum sentence and sent me to the state penitentiary in Jeff City. And that was kind of a... That exposed me to social drinking and social drug use. You know, in this penitentiary, I made wine 20 gallons at a time. They stopped making wine because I made superior quality wine. And I had access to different drugs, and, you know, you do that stuff there. And I got out, and I never wanted to go back until it came time to come into recovery. And I thought, God, don't do that to me. Send me back to the penitentiary, please. You know? So I didn't know what to expect from you folks. You know? I did 2 years' time. They let me out. They sent me back to California. They said, we don't want you here. You know? And 7 years before that, California says, go back to Missouri. Stay with your old man. We don't want you here. You know, so I felt rejected in 2 states. You know? I think I'll eat some worms, you know, that kind of stuff. If I came back and at first I did okay. I was a hero of my family. You know, because I survived that bad old penitentiary. You know, and I did good time. I was an ideal inmate. They did a psychological evaluation on me at Jeff City. The guy came down and he says, you'll be an ideal inmate. You'll get along good with the administration. You'll get along good with the other inmates. I said, oh, that's good. And they said, no, that's bad. I said, why? They said, well, you might like it here and decide to spend the rest of your life in places like this. I said, no. You know, I remember going up for the parole board after being down for about 2 years, and I was going to be the first person in the state of Missouri to ever make parole on a 10-year sentence the first time up. You know, I said to myself, if they don't let me out, I'm going to teach them a lesson. I'm just going to run down a walkway and cut people's heads off. That'll teach them. And they talked to me at this parole board, and they make you stand at the head of the table, and they let you know they got your heart in their hands. You know, they can do anything they damn well want to with you. Yeah. And they said, well, evidently, you think you're somebody special, Mr. Lemon. I said, you betcha. When I was in sixth grade, I got straight A's. I was class president. I was the most popular kid in school. You know? And when I went to work for the sewage treatment plant in Kansas City, I was the hotshot sewage operator. If you guys hadn't interfered in my life, I'd be somebody today. You know? And this guy, I don't know if he'd ever been to the program, but he did a very program thing. You know? He said, you know, that's old-timer talk for Ray Vaughn, you lunatic. Just keep coming back. You ever see him do that? You know, it's a language all their own, you know? And it won't tell you what it means. You got to stick around long enough so that you can do it to someone else, and then you know what it means. You know? And this guy says, well, Mr. Lemon, we're going to give you a year to change your attitude. You know? And I didn't cut nobody's head off. And I was sad, you know. And I talked to another guy. There's another guy in the program down in SAC, and he used to play handball off the gas house wall at MSP, you know. You know, those guys used to run by it. They'd have to walk by it to go to chow. That's cruel and inhuman punishment, I think. I don't know about you, but it's like, let's go to dinner, you know. And there's the gas house. You know, I know guys that walk by like that, you know. But this guy, he and I spent a lot of time, and people say, you know, which do you change first, the attitude or the behavior? And everybody on this side, got to change the attitude first. You got a dirty, rotten attitude, you're going to, you know. And all these people say, you got to change the behavior. You got to actuate a better thinking, you know. And I've been here, and I hadn't really made a decision on that. All I decided is, you know, I took care of that controversy about where I belonged. I belong where I am right now. You know, I go where I want to be. You know, and people love me and want me and need me. You know, that's beside the point. I cleared that up. But for a long time in recovery, I hadn't cleared up this question about what you change first, the behavior or the attitude. Old Andy walked up to me one time and he says, you know what, Scott, that's a good point. He says, I think I got a solution. I think we'll share this solution. You know, and I trusted him because he'd done time at MSP. And he was recovering. He was clean and sober, you know, with a little time. And I trusted him because he was about half wacko, too. You know, you never trust anybody that's all the way there, you know. He says, I got the solution. He says, you know, he says, my attitude didn't get me locked up. My actions got me locked up. He says, but my attitude kept me locked up. So get on. Get on. I don't have to do time anymore. You know? I work on my attitude a lot, you know. I got people that love me, and it don't matter what anybody else anywhere in the whole world does to me. Because I got someplace to go. They repossessed my car this morning. It's, you know, I had the money in my hand. I'm a little irked about it, you know. Brian talks about, I sense that you're angry about that. Some counselor told me once, I sense that you're angry. I said, you're wrong, buddy. Well, this is not anger. Anger is when I ball my chair up and put it in the middle of your desk, and when I walk out the door, it's hanging on the hinges. This is not anger, you know. Anyway, this tow truck operator angered me a little bit today. And, you know, there was no reason for that. You know, I had the money in my hand. You know? But I don't know where he's going to go if his conscience bothers him. You know? I come here. You know? And I guess if he showed up, I ain't seen him yet, you know. But my wife promised she'd point him out to me if we ever run into him, you know. But I guess if he came in the door, I'd love him too. You know, because that's what gets me better. Because I love all you folks. You know. And I used to think that the mark of the quality of my life and how successful I was as a human being was how many people loved me on this earth. You know? I got a lot of people that love me, but that's not it. That's not the measure of my success as a human being. Measure of my success as a human being is how many people I love to the best of my ability on a daily basis. You know? So if you're here tonight and you get a chance to touch hearts with me, you know, maybe we've done some of that, you know, but I'm into hugs. I plant hugs. I got this latest thing, you know. Come on, let's split a hug. I kind of like it. You know? That way you win and I win too. You know? But if we get a chance to bump hearts during this whole thing, you know, I'll be a better person for it. You know, I intend to keep coming back, you know, and, you know, Morris taught me a lot of things. Morris was kind of drug me around, you know, against my will, you know. I never really called them names. I used to mutter a lot. You know, that's newcomer talk. You know? Yeah, I'll go, but I won't like it. You know? That's the equivalent. That's a newcomer equivalent to... You know? Check it out. Next meeting you go to, you know, pick you out a newcomer and watch him for the whole meeting. And pick you out an old-timer and kind of... It's like a tennis match. You know, the thing about it is there's room for all of us, you know, and Morris taught me about loving people and about praying for people, you know, and I no longer find it necessary to develop the overwhelming desire to snatch people's lungs out anymore, you know. I went to Morris one time, I said, Morris says, pray for the person that you have a resentment against. So you don't understand, Morris. You know, if I come face to face with this guy, I'm snatching his lungs out. You know? Morris says, while you try this, and he... you know. You know, it made me crazy, you know? And it was like, okay, I'll try it, but when it don't work, it's your fault, buddy. You know? And my first prayer was, you know, I hope the sucker gets it. You know, Moore says, pray that he gets everything you want. I said, he's already got it. He's got my wife, my car, my house. You know, and Moore says, uh-huh. Yeah. He says, you want to go to a meeting, Scott? And I said, well, I thought about spending some time with my family. And go, uh-huh. So, you must want to get drunk. Oh, no, that's the last thing I want to do. He said, people that don't want to go to meetings want to get drunk, want to get loaded. You don't have to like it. No one said nothing about liking it. You know? People say, well, the answer to everything is acceptance. You know, I must accept you as a human being. You know, I don't have to like you, but I must accept you. You don't have to accept anything. You know, IRS comes to send you that letter. You don't have to accept it. Throw it in the garbage. You know, you don't have to accept nothing. It don't change your reality. I'll tell you that. You know, I never accepted going to jail. Didn't keep me from doing the time. For a long time, I didn't accept a higher power. It didn't keep me from being spiritual. You know? Human beings are by their very nature, spiritual entities. The definition of spirit is breath of life. Drinking and using, if you're still sucking air, you're a spiritual creature. Within 3 days of becoming a non-spiritual person, you don't have to worry about it. Everybody's going to know you're not spiritual anymore. You start smelling different. You get real stiff and real cool. You do? So I encourage you, keep coming back. I always talk over. I never mean to. But I always, you know, just kind of rationalize it, you know? Oh, well, they'll love me anyway. And you always do. You know? But I love you. I love you, and that's important. And I remember one meeting we talked. In fact, it was in Auburn, huh? I talked in a meeting. And he started crying. It made me cry. It made him cry more. It made me cry more. You know? But our hearts touched, and we don't see each other but once a year, once every 2 years. You know? We keep coming back. If you want to touch hearts with us, and if you want to associate with dope fiends of our variety, you know, you'll keep coming back too. You know? Because the places we tend to go, the places you will go if you don't keep coming back here, I don't like to frequent anymore. You know? Every time someone calls me up and says, will you come to the jail and see me? The first thing out of my mouth is, I don't like coming here to see you. You know? I'm not going to make it a habit of this. And you better change your habit of this. You know? I love you. You know, but I'd rather touch your heart out on the street. You know? So, I do that. You know, this keeps us going. You know, it's not infallible. You know, some of us do stuff clean that we have to pay for, you know. Well, they call it wreckage of the present. God. You know? Which implies that there may even be wreckage of the future. You know, you develop healthy relationships, that changes. You know, the risk factor goes down. You know, sometimes I think, you know, touching hearts is okay. It's other parts of your body that ain't too cool, you know. But I ain't judgmental about it. You I love y'all. Thanks for being here. And Brian, thank you for sharing with us. You, like, you're about half the reason I got pumped up. The other half is that Englishman behind you, you know. thing is, here, even Englishmen become relatively trustworthy. I love y'all. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.